All right, so thank you very much for the invitation to talk here to you guys. I thought I would do like a little overview of what relativistic quantum information is, more or less, and then talk about a couple of circumstances and situations, right? And then two particular cases, two particular results that I would explore with you guys continuously. Please do interrupt any time that you feel you have questions, so don't feel bad about it. So I prepare way more material than there's going to be time to explain to you. So don't feel that you're going to interrupt me and not let me finish, because that's going to happen anyway, so not a problem. All right, so relativistic quantum information. So relativistic quantum information, it's the study of quantum information together with general relativity and quantum field theory. So let me just talk about a little bit of what kind of questions we address. So we look at cosmology as well. For example, one of the things that we're going to see today, well, I think hopefully today we have time, it's how much information actually reaches us from the early universe. There's also, of course, black hole physics, and in particular, the information loss problem. So we know that quantum mechanics preserves information. So well, what happens in black holes, right? Can information escape black hole? So is the black hole a machine that really destroys information, really? Or what's going on? We're also hopefully going to talk a little bit about vacuum fluctuations. How vacuum fluctuates. Do you guys see this jittering a bit, maybe? Or is this me? Maybe it's just because I'm too close. We're going to talk a little bit about how much information is there about the structure of space-time in the fluctuations of the vacuum of a quantum field. There are other problems, for example, the problem of localization. When you have relativity and you have quantum systems, so many times we say, oh, we have a qubit. So a qubit lives in a particular region of space. Now, when you consider relativistic systems, so very often we implement those things in, I don't know, states of light, for example. Like people say, oh, we encode this in the polarization of a photon or something like that. But what does that mean to encode something in the polarization of a photon? Where does that information live? We know from fundamental results in quantum theory that photons, for example, per se, or the states of the electromagnetic field of a constant number of particles cannot be localized. So where does the information live? And are we really safe if we have that information contained in a finite amount of, or we believe we have that information contained in a finite amount of space? There are also problems in controlling quantum systems. So finding fixed points in quantum evolution, and in particular when we allow thermalization, what happens when we input also relativistic consideration in the thermalization of quantum systems? What happens when we have gravity? Can we control quantum systems in the presence of these two backgrounds? Of course, the big question, like how can we make quantum gravity, gravity work together with quantum theory in a consistent way, which is something in which I think information has a lot to do and a lot to say. Another fundamental result, I call it space-time engineering. Can we manipulate quantum information in a way that we are able to efficiently create distributions of stress energy in quantum fields such that they can generate exotic space-times? Like, for example, here's an example with one student of mine that is on archive recently that you can check if you're interested. Of course, there are like technological applications, and I will talk about one tomorrow, very likely, in which, okay, can we actually use our knowledge of relativistic theory to do better in quantum information that we do without taking those into account? So generation of quantum resources, and we will talk about that tomorrow. Communication, we will hopefully talk a little bit about that today. Metrology, and as I said, simulations and quantum control. So to begin, like a little bit of an introduction. So relativity matters for quantum information. Why? Why so? Let me just delve a little bit into relativity, just special relativity. You guys have taken courses in relativity already, I assume, and also some quantum field theory, perhaps. Fantastic. So I do this many times, so if you already know it, don't ask. OK, I'm going to do a little bit of a poll here. But if you don't know, have you guys heard about the rocket paradox before? If you haven't, you're allowed to participate. If you have, please do not, because it's not fun. Okay? So this is the place where theoretical physicists live, right? I always say like it's the place where cows are massless and spherical and so on, have all the symmetries. And in that planet, in that universe, these are two rockets, okay? And these two rockets are tied with a string. But the string is a very fragile string, so it will actually break the moment the string feels any tension at all, okay? And the two rockets are identical, like theoretical physics identical, no space for any kind of fluctuations or anything like that. So these two rockets will accelerate with the same proper acceleration, okay? And in fact, when we're watching them, we see them lift off like this, okay? So they go at the same speed, according to me, at every point. So the question we ask is like, okay, they're tied by a rope, so if there's any tension in the rope will break. And we ask the question, does the rope break or not? Okay? And why? Again, I always say why is not the kind of questions that we answer in physics, because in physics we answer more hows, not whys. I mean, a why is something that can satisfy you or not. It's more like a piece in our minds, I guess. But by why, I mean phenomenology. Like, how can we make sense of whatever happens here in all possible reference frames that we describe it? Okay, so here's the space-time diagram, and here's the trajectory of the two rockets. The x dimension is height here, okay? So they're going up, both rockets. And they are accelerated and constant acceleration, so the trajectory of these two rockets are hyperbolas in space-time. And we have two reference frames that we can choose to describe this thing in. Reference frame number one is, well, let's call it the lab frame. So the person who's staying on the ground, right, and seeing the launch site and seeing the two rockets lift off. That would be us looking at the rockets usually when we see them on TV, right, lifting off. So of course, at time zero, they were at the same position. At time one, they advance a little bit, and they are at the same distance. At time two, they are at the same distance. Of course, those are the place of simultaneity for someone just seeing the whole thing from outside. That person will say, well, yeah, the rope doesn't really break because these two guys are always at the same distance. Okay? So yeah, this is the way the person on Earth, person on like on the ground, will describe the whole situation. Now, we have another point of view. We can ask if the rope will break. So this guy, of course, concludes that the rope doesn't break, right? Because they're at the same distance. And then we have another point of view, which is the point of view of one of the rockets. From the point of view of one of the rockets, of course, at time zero, the planes of simultaneity of the person on the ground and the two rockets are the same because the speed, the relative speed of them is zero, between them is zero. But at different times, the planes of simultaneity for the first rocket is going to be like this. And another later time is going to be that one. So the first rocket actually is seeing the rocket number two getting farther away, and they will phone them and say, hey, you're going too fast. You're supposed to go at the same acceleration as me, like whatever, 9.8, whatever you want. And the other rocket would say, and then you're going too fast. And the other rocket would actually say, what do you mean? You are going too fast. You should actually slow down. And you're accelerating faster than me. So from the point of view of the first rocket, two rockets with the same proper acceleration would not measure the same acceleration on the other rocket, okay? Now, from this point of view, the two rockets are getting farther away, therefore the rope tying the two will break because it's very fragile. So the moment they get any tension, it breaks, okay? So from the point of view of one of the rockets, the rope will break. And now my question is for you guys, so it's a little poll if you don't know this. Does the rope break or not? How many people think it will break? No one. How many people think it will not break? All right. Well, you know what? It actually breaks. So you see, the answer to the question is objective. So this is why I call it physics, meaning that can I use the rope later on, 5 minutes later? The answer cannot be, depend who you ask, right? Ask this person, because for me, the rope actually broke. So the answer is actually that it breaks. It's very unintuitive. That's why it's got a famous name and paradox after it, right? Not really paradoxes. I mean, here what paradox means is just, okay, we don't understand it pretty well, so it looks like we arrived to different contradictory answers depending on what we assume. But not really. There's only one answer. And now we need to make sense of the answer, meaning that that's the why thing that I... So what's the phenomenology? So this is physics. The rope breaks. So how do we explain why it breaks in one reference frame and the other? For the accelerated observer, it's actually pretty easy because, it's breaking because rocket B is faster than us. It's going faster. For the person on the ground, though, what we have here, it's a rope. Just think about it. So this is going up, by the way, so because I don't want to go. My arms are limited, but I can always walk. So you have two rockets, right? So you have a rope tied between the two. And the system is accelerated and going to higher speeds. And the two rockets remain at the same distance, according to me. However, they are accelerating, so they go faster and faster. So you guys remember what happens with an extended object that gets higher speed? According to me, what would happen to it? So if I have something extended and it moves relativistic speeds, according to me, what happens with it? What happens with the length? Does it contract? It does, right? The Lorentz contraction is the way I would see tensions appearing there, because the internal forces of the rope are trying to resist, if you want, the constant acceleration. There are tidal forces in the rope. So an ideal object would contract. The rope is a physical object. There are going to be tensions, and it's going to break. Okay. So from the point of view of the inertial observer, one can say, it's an extended object that is moving. Therefore, there's no solid, rigid solid in relativity will break. Okay. So this is an example just to show that the phenomenology, it could be different, even though the physics is the same. Okay. So depending who you ask, the answer could be different. And things like our measures of entanglement and all those things that we use and manage in quantum information, those things are not things that are invariant under Lorentz transformations, all right? So, for example, and why is this relevant? I'm going to attack here the way popular science talk about entanglement because, well, sometimes. Yeah? Anyway. So we know from special relativity that simultaneity is relative, right? If we have observers, let's say at B, we have three different observers moving with different speeds to each other. They register a different, so for two space-like separated events, like A and C, they are space-like separated, different people would not agree on what happens first, okay? For different people moving with different relative speeds, A can happen after C, or A can happen before C, or they can happen simultaneously. Okay, simultaneity depends on the observer. And why is this relevant at all? Well, because we want to talk about something that many times and very often is spoken to in terms of interpretationals that are like Copenhagen interpretations that are kind of incompatible with this picture. So you're already familiar with quantum mechanics, okay? And you're probably familiar with this, right? It made the first page, actually, but not like this, but it made the first page of the New York Times when the Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen talked about entanglement and how entanglement was weird and how it was like seemingly difficult to make compatible with relativity. And the problem was that entanglement, as you guys know, corresponds to correlations that are slightly different from classical. So example with classical correlations, black ball and white ball, I put them in a bag, and I put the two in a bag, and then I pick one. So I let you guys pick one at random, right? And I don't look, and I'm like a magician. So no, just pick one. And then I come here, I look inside, I get the black one, and I look at it and say, oh, I'm going to guess yours is white. And you're not going to be very impressed, right? Because you guessed because you knew there's only a white ball and a black ball in there. So if you had the black one, it means that I took the white one. Makes sense. So those are classical correlations. However, of course, we know that if we classically put two sets of dice and we throw them, we're not going to be able to just throw in one of them. We're not going to be able to guess what's going to happen with the other one. Exactly. I have no means to know the result. But if the dice are in an entangled state, it is possible they're quantum dice. It is possible that with a throw of the dice that Alice can guess what Bob measured or will measure, okay? Now, the problem with this kind of correlations is I just picked a random famous outlet, you know, like that talk about entanglement. And they say things like, particles don't obey the same rules as people. It's very insightful. Poke a particle and another one far away can instantly respond to the touch without any messages passing through the space between them as if the two particles were one. Right, so problems with this kind of descriptions in popular science. Who pokes what? Like, those interpretations in popular science often relied on collapse of the wave function, that we have an entangled state, Alice's measures here, that therefore collapses the state, right? And then affects what the outcome of Bob's gonna be. This kind of spooky action kind of description. Now, problem with that is that if we do a description of entanglement in terms of collapse, then relativity will be bothering us because, yeah, Alice measures and therefore collapses. Well, if A and C are space-like separated, as you can have them, you can have two entangled states and take them far away and do measurements when they remain space-like separated. Well, who collapses what depends on who you ask. Different people would not agree on who is collapsing the thing. Okay, so it's a bad description, really, to think, oh, I'm missing one. It's a bad description to think of entanglement in terms of collapse of the wave function if you are serious about relativity, okay? It's more about correlations and the preparation of the state. It's is such that we have a state with properties that are not classical at all, but it means that any time that Bob measures, whatever Alice has measured or not, what I know is they're gonna be correlations between the outcome of the measurements of the two, no matter when in time or space they do them, right? Anyway, so this is just to introduce that in these discussions, above all when we talk like without really getting rigorous about it, one has to be careful with relativity. Now, relativistic quantum information mixes three fields, right? We have relativity, special and general relativity, quantum field theory, and quantum information. And basically, two directions. So harness relativistic approaches to try to do better in quantum information. We're gonna see an example of that in the next lecture, hopefully. And study the structure of space-time and the quantum nature of gravity via quantum informational tools. So try to use what we know about quantum information to learn more about gravity, okay? And the structure of space-time in general. Those are the two approaches. I should make sure that this is power. Okay, good. Another quick example that you guys may have heard, what is called the black hole information paradox, the information loss problem. You guys familiar with that? I mean, as PSI students, you are probably exposed to this like every other day or something, no? I don't know, that's my assumption, because it's trendy, and you are here at PI, so you will hear about that. There's many people coming here that know a lot about that. This is a real picture. This is a real simulation, if you want. This shows you why it's a bad idea to hide behind a black hole. This is Earth orbiting, much closer though, but orbiting a solar mass kind of black hole, small Earth though. And as you can see, hiding behind, there's no point because when you're behind, light is bent around and it will reach me no matter what. So bad idea, never try to hide behind a black hole. Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about a simplified version of stellar collapse. Imagine that I have a quantum field, okay? That quantum field could be whatever, particles with mass, or it could be let's consider something massless. For example, the electromagnetic field or a scalar field that is massless to simplify. So imagine that you have the vacuum state of the quantum field. And usually, a good representation for that state could be this, okay? So we have that. And now something happens. So I'm not gonna enter into the details of stellar collapse, which is a little bit a kind of an involved process, but think about a force in the world that has some high probability to generate a collapse of some kind, right? So something happens, think about something like that. And then suddenly, we form a black hole, okay? So out of nothing, imagine that there were dust, almost nothing, right? We form that dust collapses and forms a black hole. And then we can ask, what happened to the field that was originally in the vacuum? Right, so what happens, summarizing it a lot, I'm gonna be rather fast here. What happens is if you do quantum field theory on top of an idealized stellar collapse, what you get is that the vacuum state of the field evolves into something like this, which is a squeeze state. You guys know what a squeeze state is? It's a continuous variable, highly entangled state, okay? Well, it depends on the degree of squeezing, depends on the value of this R, but it's an entangled state. So the vacuum evolves into an entangled state of modes that fall into the event horizon, or will eventually fall into the event horizon, and modes that will reach the asymptotic region. So it's a idealized stellar collapse into a Schwarzschild kind of black hole, so we have a well-defined future for photons, okay? And there are the modes that reach that future and the modes that fall into the horizon. And it so happens that this is what we get. Before and after the collapse, much time before and much time after, what we have is something like the vacuum, nothing. And then we have, if you want, quanta of the field reaching the future, and if you want, quanta of the field falling into the horizon. Don't want to. This is a very pictorial way. I mean, it's not really accurate because it talks about particles, and particles are not well defined in these cases. But the main point being that if you look at a black hole from far away, you're going to see something, only the modes that reach the future. You're not going to see the modes that fell into the horizon, right? So we need to remove the information about the modes that fell into the horizon. We do that by partial tracing those modes, okay? And when we are left with, when we partial trace the modes that fall into the horizon, is something like this. But that kind of state for a free field can be recognized rather easily. It happens to be a thermal state of radiation that reaches the future. And that thermal state happens to have this thermal distribution, and the temperature is kind of nice because it combines H bar, G, C, and Boltzmann's constant. Pretty neat. It combines all the important theoretical physics, I guess. Okay, you have thermodynamics, you have gravity, you have quantum theory, you have relativity. Okay. Happens to be a thermal state of radiation. So basically, if you look at a black hole from far away, what you would see is something like that, something like a black body, something emitting thermal radiation. Okay, now, the problem of the black hole information loss, again, it's very similarized. So let's do it in stages, right? Stage number one. If we believe in quantum theory, information cannot be lost. And it so happens that thermal radiation is a thermal state contains the smallest amount of information for a limited amount of energy that we can have, okay? So there is no information really coming out of thermal radiation, but information can fall into the black hole. So where did the information go? Easy solution. Well, maybe the thermal is not, so the outgoing radiation is not really thermal, okay? So because we know similar scenarios in everyday physics, right? You can have a laser beam pointing at a piece of charcoal at absolute zero. It's something that happens every day, I guess. But in mind that you have a piece of charcoal at absolute zero, so it's a pure state. There's no entropy in it. And then we have a laser beam, which happens also to be a pure state of light. Then we beam it, we burn the charcoal, right? And the charcoal heats up and starts emitting thermal radiation, no? It absorbs the laser beam and emits thermal radiation. But no one complains about loss of unitarity there, because we know quantum field theory is unitary and the physics of the charcoal are unitary, we know that. So what we know is gonna happen is that, it looks like thermal radiation, right? But at some point, that sharp piece of charcoal is gonna start emitting information. No? It's not true that it's gonna be purely thermal if we analyze the time correlations of it. So what this piece of charcoal is going to do is like, yeah, the radiation is gonna look thermal at the beginning, but then eventually at some point, the charcoal is gonna go back to absolute zero. So in the end, we go back to a pure state if we factor out, so what entered was a pure state, right? Light and piece of charcoal at absolute zero. In the intermediate state, we have a piece of charcoal in a mixed state, in a thermal state, okay, that is emitting radiation. But we know in the end the charcoal ends up in a pure state again, okay, because it falls back to absolute zero when it keeps emitting. So what happened with that, with the unitarity there? Well, what happens is that if you consider all the radiation that was emitted, the radiation at the beginning looked a lot thermal, but then at the end of the cooling down of the piece of charcoal, there were correlations emitted as well. So if you consider all the radiation emitted, it's gonna be a pure state again, okay? So that we know. So question, can a black hole be like a piece of charcoal? And that's what Dan Page, summarizing a lot, proposed. Dan Page, you guys are familiar with the Page curve and things like those? I don't know if you guys have heard about it, but basically it's like this red line here. It's what should happen if the black hole. So black holes are thermodynamic monsters in the sense that the heat capacity is negative. So they are very unstable. The more energy they emit, the hotter they get, okay? Which is the opposite of things that are stable thermodynamically, like this thing. The hotter this thing is, the more it emits, okay? So when it's emitting radiation, the temperature goes down, okay? This guy, if I heat it up, the temperature goes down and it emits radiation. Black holes are the opposite, so negative heat capacity, okay? So the emission of entropy by a black hole should grow like that, okay? However, Dan Page, if it were like purely thermal until the full evaporation of the black hole, Dan Page proposed Right. So what about it's like kind of thermal at the beginning, but then like a piece of charcoal at some point, the black hole starts spitting out information. So it looks thermal if I only look instantaneously for short times, but maybe if I look for longer times, there are going to be correlations between radiation emitted in the past and radiation emitted in the future. So it's not really a thermal state, the whole thing. Right, so solution, possible solution. The outflow is not entirely thermal. And then, well, we got to the modern problems in the information loss problem. That's potentially even worse. So we have a tripartite state, if you want. We have the radiation emitted before page time. We have the infalling radiation. So there's the radiation that crosses the horizon. There's the radiation emitted before page time, and there's the radiation emitted after page time. And as I showed you, the radiation that is infalling and the radiation emitted at any time, it's entangled. And actually, it's more and more entangled the more the black hole temperature increases, the more the mass of the black hole is reduced, the more the black hole evaporates. Problems that appear, and then it's doubtful if we have that problem, but anyway, problems that appear, you guys probably have heard in this course, I assume, something about entropy subadditivity, and in particular, consequences that it has in entanglement. We have entanglement subadditivity. In particular, when this equality is saturated, we call it entanglement monogamy, usually. So you cannot be entangled, maximally entangled at the same time with two parties, okay? And the problem is that if we have three of these parties and in a limit, two of them become maximally entangled, how can you explain, for example, the radiation emitted after page time and the infalling radiation, they eventually become maximally entangled. How is it possible then that that radiation is also entangled with radiation emitted in the past? Okay, that violates entanglement subadditivity. And then people, that's a problem. Again, there are subtleties because we may be talking about infinite dimensional systems, and those things start to be like fishy when we talk about infinite dimensional systems. But if we assume, for example, there's a finite number of degrees of freedom in the black hole and in the radiation, which again, doubtful, it would be an impeccable argument for finite dimensions. With infinite dimensions, maybe. Okay, I'm not going to enter in that. People came up with solutions. Still, a grave enough problem for people to think a lot about it. So Leonard Susskind and then other people studied it. Leonard Susskind was like main idea, but then other people studied it rigorously. Talked about something called black hole complementarity. It's neat. It was a neat solution. It's basically saying that an identification between the interior and the exterior of the black hole, so that really the internal degrees of freedom of the black hole inside the horizon are not really different from what's outside. It's more than that, obviously. But then again, it's a simplification. It was elegant. Many people liked it until some people kind of proved that it was wrong, or at least there was something wrong with it, apparently. So we have the Ames paper that maybe you've heard if you go to talks about people that talk about firewalls here, which is the trendy bit of this. They prove that some of the assumptions made together to get something like black hole complementarity are not compatible. Okay, and they propose something like firewalls, a solution like firewalls. So what is the firewall solution? Just making it super simplified. It's let's make this zero. So let's break the correlations between infalling radiation and outgoing radiation somehow. Let's introduce a mechanism that makes this zero, therefore no problem anymore. Okay, simplifying a lot, of course. And then what you get is that you can do that, you can cut correlations. If you cut it, you pay a price, and the price that you pay is that you get at the horizon that general relativity predicts is super regular and nothing happens, right? You get something dramatic. You get divergences in the stress energy tensor when you cut those correlations. And those divergences is what people call firewalls, okay? Now, personally, so this is something that relativistic quantum information has a lot to say about. Personally, this violence at the horizon, I'm not an advocate for that, as you can tell. So I don't believe in firewalls myself. But then again, it's an interesting model, and it's an interesting thing to study. I have no idea what the solution is. It's just I don't think it's too reasonable for several reasons. But then again, there are as many opinions as physicists. Okay, so that motivates a little bit why relativistic quantum information is maybe interesting, right? Let me talk about two different particular, how am I doing time-wise? Okay, two different particular results. I'm going to talk about today, and maybe the beginning of tomorrow, about something called quantum collect calling. And tomorrow I will talk about vacuum entanglement harvesting and farming, okay? Right, so communication through massless fields. What are the general properties of something like that? You guys are used to that because you have phones with Wi-Fi, and then you do use wireless communication every day with massless fields. Usually you guys communicate with the electromagnetic field, right? All right, sometimes with phonons when you speak and so on, but let's consider just the electromagnetic field for now. What are properties? I'm going to tell you a list of properties and you tell me they're reasonable or not. So, communication is mediated by real energy carrying quanta. Seems reasonable, right? So an emitter emits photons, a receiver captures photons. And that's the way you communicate. No? Seems reasonable? Okay. Information flows, therefore, are carried by energy flows. Of course, I say average here. One can be clever, as quantum information theories are really clever. So when you say things like that, they will tell you, no. I can't communicate without exchanging energy. I can tell you, tomorrow, you're going to the cinema. I will join you. If I give you a call, I'll go. If I don't call you, then means that I won't go. Okay, and then you don't call, and then you transmitted some info because you prearranged a protocol. Yeah, sure, you can do that once. But if you plan to do that every day, sometimes you, with some probability, you're going to go, and therefore you have to spend energy, right? Anyway, information flows are carried by energy flows. This is Stephen Susskind in his book says many times. Of course, you cannot transmit information decoupled from the transmission of energy. You send energy, you send information, right? So information reaches you when energy reaches you. Seems reasonable, no? You emit electromagnetic waves that carry some momentum and some energy, and that depends who you ask. It could be more momentum or more energy. But again, some momentum and some energy, and it will reach you, okay? And that carries the information. Also, communication is only possible at the speed of light, okay? It's definitely not possible faster than light, but it's also not possible slower than light because you're using electromagnetic radiation, right? And if you don't have mirrors or a medium or something like that, then light travels at the speed of light. And information should travel at the speed of light. Agreed? With a massless field I'm talking about. So if you miss the beam, you miss the message. If I have a laser pointed like this and I just start beaming this empty chair, like this or somewhere like that, right? If there's no one there to capture the beam, the message is lost because light went away, right? So someone can come in like in an hour, sit there an hour later, and then try to get the message, they're not gonna, right? Because the message is gone. I mean, someone that comes an hour later after I have beamed the chair, right? There's no way that they're gonna recover any information. Seems reasonable, no? Okay, so the main result I'm gonna tell you about is that those reasonable assumptions about communication are generally not true. None of them, okay? Sometimes they are true, okay? But not generally, no. Okay, so when are they not true? Okay, let me make the claims first. I like how the way they wrote. Like they call it photon afterglow. Sometimes I use popular science to attack them. Sometimes they're actually better than me characterizing things that we work on. So they call it afterglow, right? So information can propagate arbitrarily slow in massless fields, even in the vacuum, of course. In vacuum, that's what I should do, not a medium. You can recover a message even if the beam is missed. So that person maybe come in an hour and recover the message even though light that you emitted is passed, right? Information flows don't need to be supported by real quanta being transmitted, in particular by energy flows. So information flows can happen in absence of energy flows through quantum fields. And that seems like a hard sell, huh? How is that? That defies many of the things that we assume when we do communication in quantum optics. People always talk about photons supporting the information, right? Or something like that. Okay, let's go to the math of what I'm going to use to sell you this, that it's possible to communicate without exchange of energy. So the Strong-Huygens principle, this is classical. We haven't gotten quantum yet. Strong-Huygens principle says the Green's function of the massless wave equation in 3 plus 1D Minkowski space has support only on the light cone. Hence, any disturbances propagate strictly along null geodesics, means at the speed of light. So all that I told you that doesn't really work it does work in flat 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetimes. So, well, yeah, in this room, it's very approximately we're in 3 plus 1 Minkowski, right? Very approximately. So, yeah, I mean, maybe if someone comes, they're not going to be able to recover that message. But one can ask, oh, how stable? So if I start perturbing the assumptions of the theorem here, how resilient will be the claim? And the answer is not very, no, not really, not resilient at all. The moment I relax any single bit of this guy, the Strong-Huygens principle will not apply. So if I consider flat, different dimensional, so if I consider a two-dimensional or a four-dimensional or a one plus one-dimensional space-time, Strong-Huygens principle does not apply. The Green function, we have support inside the light cone as well, not only on the light cone. In fact, for flat space-time, even number of spatial dimensions and one spatial dimension have that feature. They violate the Strong-Huygens principle. So an optical fiber, to a good approximation, will violate the Strong-Huygens principle. And if I relax Minkowski, then yeah, forget about it. You're going to have propagators that don't cancel green functions, that don't cancel radiation green functions, that don't cancel at all inside the light cone. In fact, mathematicians that look at this problem classically, what they try to find is spacetimes where actually it happens that this principle exists. There are very, very few. Okay? Now, question, can you use this for communication? Not really, no. This is some kind of a mathematical, classically speaking, with classical fields, there's no known way to use this to communicate. So still, you're getting 1 plus 1D, it's a clean-cut case. Energy only propagates on the light cone, okay? You still have a non-zero green function in the future light cone, but you cannot really, with a classical dipole antenna, you cannot really use that for communication. But when we have quantum emitters, it is possible to exploit that. Quantum emitters can communicate using the time-like bit of the propagator in the light cone, in the time-like region of the light cone. Okay, the technical details of what I'm going to tell you are in these papers here, okay? I'm going to tell you about cases in cosmology in particular, so how much information reaches us from early universe physics, okay? In these kinds of time-like channels, the Huygens channels is the way we actually call them. Also, this is a very nice paper by Robert Johnson. Okay, let me just acknowledge people here. Robert Johnson was a former student of Achenkamp. Now he's a postdoc. Ana Blasco is a student, master student, was a master student in Madrid. Luis Garay, professor in Madrid. Mercedes Martín Benito used to be a postdoc here at Perimeter. Now, she went to Holland, now she's in Portugal, in Lisbon. And Peter is an undergraduate, actually, student in the University of Waterloo. Okay? So there's also this nice paper where Robert actually analyzed more in depth the propagation of energy in the 1 plus 1D case, for example, and other considerations. Anyway, what I'm going to tell you about is mostly this. So, the radiation green function, right, of a massless field has support only on the light cone. That is the Strong-Huygens principle. That's the claim of the Strong-Huygens principle. So in particular, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, we know that this is true. In 3 plus 1 dimensions, it's the propagator, the commutator of the field, if you want, has support only on the light cone. It's actually a delta-like kind of support. It is not true in general. In curved spacetimes, it's definitely not true. Okay? So in curved spacetimes, you can get communications separated and decoupled from energy propagation. Okay? Okay. So let's consider the case of this spacetime here. Do you guys recognize this guy? This is what you get out of solving Einstein equations when you assume the cosmological principle and that a perfect fluid with some equation of state is generated in that spacetime. So this is the famous Friedmann-Robertson-Wilker spacetime. So it's the spacetime that we assume a good model for cosmology. It's, as you can guys see, there's isotropy here, okay, and there's homogeneity here. Okay, so we put a test scalar field quantized in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, and we couple to the background geometry. So we have a scalar field that gravitates here, okay? Only we don't consider the back reaction on the metric of that, okay? We consider the leading order in terms of the gravitational interaction. And then we're going to use particle detectors, like atoms, or qubits that have some physical entity, if you want. So a qubit In this case, it's going to be modeled by a qubit that couples to that field is an unruly detector. Unruly detector is like a two-level atom. It's the kind of models that people use in quantum optics. If you guys are exposed to quantum optics, I think you're going to be because you have Kevin Resch, or you had Kevin Resch right before. Okay, so you've been exposed to quantum optics. So you hear about things about rotating wave approximation and things like those? Maybe not, but you've heard about coupling two-level systems to light, no? Maybe. Okay, so this is a model of two-level system that we're going to couple to light, only a simplified light that is scalar. And actually, that's what they do in quantum optics. They don't consider much the full electromagnetic structure when they couple like this. Anyway, so let me just show you the decoupling Hamiltonian. That Hamiltonian has some coupling strength, lambda. Okay, we get a switching function, which controls when I switch on and off the interaction with the field. Think that you have the atom, for example, like something like a small Faraday cage, then you open it and you close it, or you measure to prepare the atom, something like that. Some process that starts the interaction at a given time with a given state. You get the internal degree of freedom of the atom, this monopole moment that has two states, two level, two eigenstates, okay? You have the element of volume here. You're integrating over the volume of the atom. This is the smearing function. So how big is the atom? Typically, it's something that comes from the wave functions of the atoms in atomic physics. If you want to know how, you can ask Richard, because he's working on something like that. Okay. That is the detector maybe moving. Okay. So this is evaluated, pulled back to the detector's trajectory. And then we coupled it to the quantum field here, to the scalar field. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So this is the interaction Hamiltonian that we're going to consider. It's pretty simple, okay? So the detector sees the field at the point where the detector exists, okay? And trust me here for now, maybe tomorrow I'll say more about it. This is a very good model for the realistic coupling of an atom and a field, okay? There's papers written about how good this model is. Right, so we're going to focus on two figures of merit. We have something that we will call signaling estimator, that is the influence of the presence of two detectors. You're going to have two detectors here. One's going to be in the far past. One's going to be in the current age, for example. Okay, and they're going to influence each other. A detector that lives in the past will influence the detector that lives in the future. We're going to compute something like that we're going to call signaling estimator. We'll get to what that is. And then we're going to quantify how much information can be sent from a detector in the far past to a detector in the future. Okay, in the context of this Friedman-Robertson-Walker background. So this signaling estimator, so if I compute the probability, imagine I have two detectors. One is in the far past, say close to the, in the early stages of what we call the early stages of the universe, and we have one in the far future. And then the probability, imagine that I prepare my detector in some state and has some initial probability of finding the detector excited. Remember, there are two levels, ground and excited, so I prepare a superposition of the two, and I have some initial probability of finding it excited, okay? Then, there are gonna be two contributions extra to that if we let the detector couple to the field and evolve. There's gonna be a part of the transition probability which is what we call the vacuum contribution. So locally, because I couple the detector to the field, there's a chance that the detector goes off. Okay, but that's independent of Alice being there in the past or not, okay? And there's gonna be a bit to that transition probability that depends on the presence of Alice, okay? That will be zero if Alice is not there, and non-zero if you put Alice in. That's what we call the signaling, the signaling estimator. The contribution to the transition probability of Bob coming from the presence of Alice, all right? And then we're gonna consider two cases. Case number one, the Big Bang setting. What does that mean? So we have a universe that is a typical prediction of cosmology in which you have a Big Bang time-like singularity in the past, okay? And then the universe expands from it, all right? So that's the prediction from the usual general relativistic models with these assumptions. Okay, so we write the equations of motion. So this is the equation of motion for the field. The field is coupled to scalar curvature like that, and also it feels that it lives in a curved spacetime because the square here contains the metric, okay? And the usual, you've seen all this, no? I hope. There are two typical couplings that people use, something called conformal coupling. This is kind of trendy as well, because conformal field theory is kind of trendy, okay? This is minimal coupling. Minimal coupling The conformal coupling is a symmetry that you may or may not have, and in fact, we have no good reason to think we have it. In fact, we know we don't have it, because fields interact. And when you have masses or interactions that look like masses when you look at one field, you don't have conformal symmetry. But it's convenient. It makes the math easy. Okay, so we use it many times. Minimal coupling is another assumption. It's like, say that this guy is zero. Okay, and it seems to give good prediction in cohomology, so it's used a lot. Okay. We're going to focus on the minimal coupling case, although I make some comments about conformal coupling. Let me just go forward. So this signaling estimator here, remember, the correction to the probability of transition of Bob because of the presence of Alice's atom in the past. Okay? So this guy, one can compute. And one can compute using perturbation theory. And the leading order correction to this, of course, depends on the coupling strength of Alice and the coupling strength of Bob. Remember, lambda were the coupling strength. So if Alice is not there, Alice never couples, the coupling strength of Alice is zero, this guy is zero. Okay? Obviously. Now, we can compute using perturbation theory what the expression for is S2 is, and then you get it here. Okay? And it depends on many things. It depends on the initial state of Alice. Alpha and beta are the coefficients of the superposition of the original state of Alice. And Bob, Alice starts from in a superposition of ground and excited with coefficients beta and alpha. And same goes for Bob. You can see here, and this is interesting, the signaling estimator depends on alpha and beta in funny ways. We will get a little bit better when we talk the commutator. And look at this. This guy here is the field commutator. And the field commutator, okay, in the case of conformal coupling, the field commutator is this guy. So this guy, the field commutator, you may recognize it using basic quantum field theory. For a scalar field, this is the field commutator for a flat spacetime, only multiplied by these guys here, which is not surprising, because in conformal coupling, we have full conformal symmetry. All that you get is things that have units get multiplied by a power of the conformal factor that corresponds to those units. So this is just the flat case times a conformal factor. Look at that. The commutator has support only on the light cone, correct? This is evaluated, a delta is evaluated on the light cone. So the signaling estimator will only be non-zero if Alice and Bob are separated by a light interval. They cannot signal if they cannot exchange real photons, if you want. Okay? Well, not surprising, it's like the flat case, the flat space-time scenario. All right. Okay, before continuing, okay, this is not too impressive, let's establish a communication protocol. The communication protocol I'm going to establish is, all right, Alice encodes a 1, coupling her detector A to the field. Okay, so to send a 1, Alice releases the Faraday cage and couples the detector to the field. And she encodes a 0 by not doing it. Okay? And in the readout, Bob switches on the detector and measures its energy, if you want, if he's excited or not. Okay? And then if B is excited, Bob interprets this as a 1. And if it's not excited, as a 0. Of course, this is noisy. Bob can measure a 1 out of vacuum fluctuations, even if Alice did nothing. And Bob can measure a 0 even if Alice did something. So it's a noisy channel, okay? And we know from information theory that in these kinds of channels, it's a noisy asymmetric binary channel. We know the channel capacity. People have studied these kinds of things. Channel capacity in bits per second, if you want. Okay, you can do, again, a perturbative analysis on that quantity, and you get that the channel capacity is proportional to the square of this signaling estimator, okay? And it's proportional to the coupling strength of Alice square and Bob square. All right. As I said, the conformal coupling gives something that is what makes sense, right? Because, what time is it? Okay. What makes sense, what we know makes sense, right? The amount of the S2 depends on the commutator, the channel capacity depends on an integral of the commutator, remember, depends on S2. What we get here is that we have a decay with spatial separation, right? We have in 3 dimensions, so the signal strength will decay, therefore the channel capacity will decay. And we have support only on the light cone. But what happens in minimal coupling? In minimal coupling, okay, we go back to S2, we get the commutator, and the field commutator in minimal coupling has this not so nice expression. It gets even less nice as we keep computing, okay? It's actually pretty nice though. It looks it's very bulky, but it's nice because it's all Bessel functions, so many things can be done analytically, okay? It's all known functions. You know the luxury we have, this is easy math, meaning that the kind of math that we can write in terms of functions that we know very well, okay? We can make another simplification, an assumption. Let's consider first a matter-dominated universe. So we set the equation of state for the fluid generated in space-time to be corresponding to non-relativistic matter. So matter, what we call matter, okay? So in those cases, the Bessel functions are particularly simple, are just superposition of trigonometric functions, okay? And we can compute the commutator. And the commutator explicitly has this form. And look at this. Look at this. So we have the same term as in the conformal coupling, and an extra term. And that term, instead of deltas of the light cone, has thetas on the light cone. So these terms are non-zero inside the light cone, okay? Not only on the light cone. And it does not decay with spatial separation, so there's a time-like leakage. Something interesting, something is that this doesn't have. Look at this guy here, this is the distance, the spatial distance between emitter and receiver. Where is that here? It's nowhere to be found. So this guy does not decay with the spatial separation. So we can compute the channel capacities in the minimal coupling case. And you can see this is the space-like region, okay? A and B are space-like here. This is light connection. And of course, the amount of information that you can exchange peaks at light connection. But look at this tail. There's a tail. The channel capacity in the time-like area is non-zero. And it does not decay with the spatial separation, whereas this guy will decay. This is for the case of the temporal separation from the Big Bang. So the closer you are to the Big Bang, the easier it will be to communicate. And it makes sense because the more curved your space-time will be, this curvature here, what is making the violation of Strong-Huygens. Remember, this is not the fact that space-time is curved and the light cones get curved. No. We're talking pure time-like separation here, not light separation, okay? And there's some decay with time in this matter-dominated case, okay? But in that case, it can be compensated, so the volume of space-time grows faster than the decay in the channel capacity. So one can think of setting an array of receivers, of bobs, if you want, around an area in the light cone. So here I start just deploying a network, and then it will cover the future light cone, and they can collaborate, and they can recover all the classical information sent by Alice. In fact, and this is Peter, not have much time for details, the last result, if the expansion is exponential, so say a universe dominated by a cosmological constant, as the one we may be seemingly going towards, not clear though, we have no idea honestly, but that's the kind of term that seems to be driving for now mainly the expansion of the universe. There's not even a decay in time. So this is particularly interesting. For now I told you like signals emitted, what time is it? So maybe I should be finishing? I don't know, what? Okay, cool. So I'm going to set the stage for the next day. So the echoes that one leaves after the atom interacts, some atom interacts in the past, the echoes, the information that is left there, is left there. It doesn't decay in time and space if the expansion is sufficiently fast. So I mentioned a Big Bang scenario. What happens in a quantum bound setting? So imagine that we live in a universe that doesn't have a singularity, okay? We don't really like singularity, so better be no singularity there. And instead, we have a universe that was contracting, reaches some critical volume, and then expands again, okay? Then we can ask, how much information survives a cosmological cataclysm? Something like that, right? So you have some universe that collapses, right? And then at some point you enter an energy density that is comparable to the Planck scale, so we don't know what happens there. But imagine that what happens there is something that makes the universe bounce back and expand. So, and then imagine that someone put some information there. So I'm going to talk about that. I mean, the thing is this is misordered, but well, whatever. So if there's some information in the in the pre-bounce era, right? The cataclysm. So we believe in quantum mechanics cannot destroy information, really, if we really believe in quantum mechanics, okay? Meaning that, yeah, there's some Hamiltonian for the universe, including gravity and so on. If we believe in quantum mechanics, then all that we can do to information is this, scramble it. That's all that we can do, but we cannot destroy it. So a cosmological cataclysm is something like this, some scrambling of the information, if we believe in quantum theory. And then maybe in that scrambling with enough time, we can actually make out some information out of it. So maybe information that what was put there in before the bounce, right, before something like that, that cosmological cataclysm will remain there for us to see. A typical example of quantum gravity models that predict that, loop quantum cosmology is one of them. In fact, loop quantum cosmology is kind of nice because gives nice from the theoretical purposes. I'm not advocating for any of those, neither, or none, I guess, of all the possible. I like some more than others. I like causal sets a lot, for example, but that's a different story. Loop quantum cosmology gives you an effective classical state of the metric. So the metric actually, the quantum effects are not too strong in the bounds. They're strong enough to correct the metric in the same way that general relativity corrects Newtonian gravity for the GPS. So they add corrections to the metric, okay, that predictions to GR, but still within a regime that we can still use an effective GR. So that's why I'm going to use that example later on. But yeah, let me just set the stage for the next day. So we know that atoms, right, won't survive a quantum bounce. Why? Because the, you know, the energy density in a quantum bounce is going to be way above the binding energy of atoms, right? So yeah, yeah. If we are in mind that we live in a universe, and our scientist tells us that, well, this universe is going to end up in a big crunch. So at some point we will cease to exist because our atoms will not make it. Even in our nuclei will not make it. The energy is too high in those. The energy density is too high in the quantum bounce. But imagine a very advanced civilization. We don't know what it looks, probably something like that. So imagine that we have a civilization that is very advanced and lived in the quantum bounds. So think of us. We've been around for how long? Like if we are generous, 100,000 years, if we are generous, okay? How much do we know about physics? Not really that much. We know some, but not really that much. And it's only been all the progress been made like in the last 500 years or so. Being generous again. Imagine a civilization that had trillions of years, okay, to do the same thing. And these guys are more intelligent than us, so they figure out physics. They know all physics that there is to know. And imagine that they find out that the real physics predicts a quantum bounce, okay? At some point, they live in a universe that's going to get to a quantum bounce and then expand again. And they don't want to die. I mean, they cannot avoid it. They're made of atoms anyways, but they don't want to die. So what can they do? What would you do if you wanted your legacy to survive, okay? It's a little toy, yeah? It's just to motivate what I'm gonna do. So one thing that you can do is encode the information in the quantum field. So you have atoms now. You will not have atoms in the future. Well, you have atoms. You can use those atoms to manipulate the field. You can be clever and assume that there's gonna be a very clever civilization in the future that might be able to get that information. So you encode all the information about yourselves in a quantum field. Because you know the quantum field will make it. Huh? Yeah, atoms will not. But the quantum field itself, it will change state. Where you, you won't have bound states anymore, but you will have states of the field. So maybe you want to encode it in a quantum field. And then assuming optimality, assuming that these guys know their physics and they encode the best way possible, and assuming that in the future at some point, someone will know exactly the same physics and will know how to do this optimally, how much information is recoverable after a quantum bounce? Oh, this is a well-posed question. So if we do something in the pre-bounce era, how much of that information will make it to the post-bounce era? And I think this is what I should probably stop. I'll finish that in the next lecture, and I'll do something else as well. All right? Cool. Any questions?
I'm not sure how to phrase the first one. You said something about atoms keeping information for longer than you would expect. You probably phrased it differently. But something like that.
Atoms keeping information.
But the information stays there for longer.
So right now, like in the last 5 minutes?
You're talking about fields now, but before that.
What I mean is like atoms don't really keep information for a long time, but So what I mean is, like, you have atoms, and you can use those atoms to encode information in the field. So I have an atom.
Okay. So it's only the field that keeps the information. It's not
is the field? Is the field eventually what keeps the information? Yes.
Because the question I was going to ask was whether people could use this to support homeopathy.
No way. No.
Okay.
No.
Right.
From my colder hands, I would say no.
Okay. Then my real question: how close are we to experimentally testing any of the predictions? Not necessarily this, but of any.
Right. In cosmology, I have no idea. So not close. In the systems of modified dimensionality, it might not be so far away. So in particular, in one things of 1+1 effective theories, like for example, transmission lines in superconducting circuits, these things can be tested. So technology exists already that spending some money, you would be able to do an experiment where you test that. The main problem would be making sure that your signal is there out of these time-like signals as opposed to any of the other many effects that you have in the system. So it requires a high degree of control. So it requires money, like spending money in making the experiment. In 1+1, I'm talking with some people at the IQC that do superconducting circuits. It's in principle possible. Main problem again is they work with models that are non-relativistic, as maybe you guys will see a little bit later on in the next lecture. And you need to be careful with all the terms there. You cannot do certain approximations, and then the correction terms are comparable to other things that will influence your signaling. So proving really that is this kind of signaling is tough. But it's in principle doable in modified. So in 1+1 dimension, we can think of quantum broadcasting, which is an application of that, in which you have an optical fiber, and then you want to send classical signal. It's quantum broadcasting of classical information. So if you can send a signal, and that's the reason why it's called quantum collect calling, you couple to an optical fiber here, so you send a pulse. The pulse goes through the optical fiber, but then you get many bobs, say that at the same time they couple to the optical fiber, and they can read out the time-like information put there. And that means that I no longer have to spend the energy broadcasting here to reach many, many receivers that are going to be losses. No, not really. I spend very little energy to send the pulse. And the energy bill of the communication is paid by every individual bob that couples to the fiber, hence the name of quantum collect calling, in the sense that they pay for the energy cost of extracting the energy from the field. It's like me leaving a note. It's like me leaving a piece of paper here for the next person to come, only that in a massless field. So the note cannot stay here. The note actually goes, the energy of the note goes away at the speed of light, but something remains. Okay.
Another question?
All right, so I'll see you tomorrow.